Welcome everyone to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community, plus a live Q&A you can't find anywhere else. It's September 4th, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator for funded startups and enterprises that helps companies who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by using our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle-tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your team launch your products faster. So head over to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. Answer a few quick questions, and you'll book a meeting with me directly. So how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for those on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. Go to cloudposse.com/officehours to subscribe. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, please share it with your team. You can find that recording on our YouTube channel. Go to youtube.com/cloudposse, and it'll be posted in a few hours. So with that said, let's get into the news and announcements for this week. All right, first one is interesting. There's been a lot of license changes happening lately. I forget the one that was most recently, just like 2 weeks ago, but now Elasticsearch has now switched back, or is rather a dual licensed project now. One of those licenses is AGPL. Obviously, AGPL is probably the least liked license by other companies, but if you're using it strictly as a server product, it doesn't contaminate your application for using it. If you are making changes to Elastic, the source code itself, you have to open source your changes to it, and that's basically AGPL. So I think this is interesting. I'd like to understand the backstory a little bit more that drove this decision. Sounds like they missed being able to call themselves open source. Any opinions on this?
I'm sure
I mean,
that
I'm a huge fan. I as soon as things go BSL or not fully open sourced, I usually ditch them. So congratulations to these guys.
share the same sentiments.
I wonder though, has this ship sailed? Is that are the alternative for, is like OpenSearch, has that progressed too far? Is this a little too late, or will this work?
OpenSearch works fine for me. So until that isn't true, I don't have an impetus to make a change right now. And it meets all my requirements. It's not broken.
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is similar to like the, well, is this is maybe I haven't been following the news on this particular product closely enough. Is this similar to like if Terraform, did their BSL thing, so people switched to OpenTofu, and then Terraform changed their mind and said, "Oh, never mind, we're open source again."
Kind of,
Yeah, I
where
probably.
instead of going back to MPL, they'd be going back to like AGPL, hypothetically. It's similar to that.
Yeah, I mean, open source is critical to me. That makes or breaks. That is a deal breaker for me on software. If it's a choice for me where I can self-host or at least use open source software, I always go that route versus the alternative. So I think this is probably a smart move by them. Whether it will win customers back, I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder. All right, Matt, any thoughts on this before I move on?
I was just going to say that I'm sure there's also some underlying business driver for them to do this, because they wouldn't go through all the legal expense of doing this yet again, if there weren't some like specific business reason that this is a necessity for them. I mean, the original reason they changed their license was basically because Amazon was cannibalizing their hard work and whatever, like commercializing the hosting offering, and they weren't able to monetize, all the work that they did as a product. So something else, I'm sure, is now driving like the reason that they're going back to this more than pure altruism. I mean, I'm sure like they like to be open source, but the business didn't spend, you know, $500,000 in legal fees for, you know, to go do this again or whatever it ended up costing them. So, yeah.
So, I mean, under this model, and I don't know AGPL well enough, does that preclude other companies from hosting it, provided those companies release the entirety of their modifications to the product for hosting it?
Yeah, that I'm not a licensing expert on this particular license, so I don't really know.
One of the things like I like just general and open source, I think it's part of the equation, but on the side is access to the technology to learn it. Before, I don't know if people were around for the Oracle days or before Oracle, where in order to get access to the technology to learn it so you could get into a job that with that technology, you would have to pay thousands of dollars. I mean, I remember some people getting F5 switches in their home that they'd buy off of eBay or whatever, just so they could learn the technology to be able to have a foothold into that market. And so when I see a lot of companies going away from open source, it's kind of it strikes terror in me that we're going to make it a kind of closed, exclusionary type, you know, market where it's going to be hard to get access to the technology and learn and get into it for the next generation. And we already have a problem with the next generation learning. You know, coming on board, being on board it.
I mean, in all fairness, though, I think a lot of these license changes aren't targeting individuals and developers, and the licenses are source available, so you can still, crack it open and look at it. And they're not really targeting, you as a learner.
No, I know that, but see, there's an aggregate effect. For example, like when you have a platform that has, like, say, a plug-in type interface where people can contribute, and their stuff is openly accessible rather than, say, through paywalls, even if the paywall is free and zero. What happens is if you put barriers in the way, it just kind of adds to the friction. So stuff that's like open, there's just all kinds, like Terraform, for example, there's all kinds of plugins, providers made by the community available for Terraform, and some surprisingly so, whereas other platforms are more closed. Don't, and they try to make money in places that really undermine their platform. And I think Elasticsearch as a business is like one of those things. If you look at their training or certification and stuff, it's going to be in the thousands of dollars, and it shows that they're not making money. And this is where they think they can make money, where something else like Prometheus and stuff is just so much more widely accessible. And their training for it, the certifications they do have is cheap. It's just
Yeah,
an aggregate effect, that halo or whatever.
sure. I know Cloud Posse is very free and open, but it doesn't translate to our bank account. But maybe we have other things wrong.
Yeah, I think that that's the crux of it. At the end of the day, the people who like the desire for it to be open and free or low cost and all of that thing are often at odds with like the hundreds and thousands of hours it takes to build and maintain these things. And like we need to come up with some sort of, I think we've talked about this in other ways, is like, you know, open source isn't free, right? It's people are either donating their time to do it because they have a problem to solve themselves, and then they share what they did, you know, to solve it. But that also doesn't scale to continue to improve things and maintain them. And the bigger a product gets and the more widely adopted it becomes, you know, the more time and effort it takes to stay on top of, you know, contributions and, you know, and support and marketing and feature enhancements and, you know, whatever it is. And that doesn't come free. And then it's almost like, well, you know, if you asked every person that used Elasticsearch to donate $5, they the you know the problem would be solved. But like on the other hand, people would be like,
That's
$5? I'm not
outrageous.
paying five. That's
$5 is
ridiculous
not worth
for
that. No
Elasticsearch,
way.
you know? Yeah. But I'm saying like it literally could be if every user gave $5 to Elasticsearch, the problem would be solved. Like they would have enough revenue for like years basically for that. There's like, tens of millions of users, kinds of things. So I don't know. It seems like we've got a problem right now in with open source and how it gets funded and how people can genuinely make a living by having open products, but also like be comfortable in their lives and not have to scrape by and like do all these other things to make it happen. So it seems like both sides of this marketplace are at odds with each other, unfortunately.
I feel I empathize with both sides.
Along those lines, real quick, I was going to say I'm so proud of myself because I finally like sponsored my first thing in GitHub. Those of us that have a decent
Awesome.
salary and have the money to spend, give your money to open source. I spend, I don't know, probably 50, 60 bucks a month on random open source products, OpenStreetMaps and like Fetty Labs and Mastodon crap and whatever, a bunch of random junk. But yeah, find some products you like, give them $5 a month. And maybe they won't do this BS. Well, no, they'll still do. They'll still go closed source because they need the money. But maybe they'll listen to the people who are giving them money more than they'll listen to just like random people who use their stuff.
Yeah, that's
Who
the
knows?
hope. Also, what I find is interesting is that, obviously means tons for individuals as yourself to do that. But I mean, this stuff is being used by for-profit companies. And like, I mean, they're paying hundreds of thousands of dollars a month or, in payroll and things, $5 here and there, $100 here and there. It doesn't even register. It's a rounding error. I wish
Yeah,
they would.
that's actually a great point. Maybe, has anyone here successfully convinced their company to give money to an open source product when they didn't have to? Because if so, that would be a definitely a huge windfall.
I
Think
think subscribing.
I know Eric will talk about it, but we've over the last 6 months or so have been pushing Cloud Posse subscriptions, and what you've definitely found is that the GitHub doesn't make it easy to subscribe and give money as an enterprise. For sure, you have to jump through all sorts of hoops to make it happen. Not the easiest thing. You really have to
That's the
want to give the money in order
problem.
to do it. It isn't just like click a button and it's not a big
Yeah,
deal.
that's
Like click,
unfortunate.
let me go. You have to sign agreements and do all sorts of crazy things with GitHub
Pay
in
in
order to make
advance
it
for like
work.
5 months and then draw that down. And yeah, it's not working.
Way easier where you could just put your credit card number in and go.
Yeah.
That's what most of us prefer, I think. It's just there's no blocker.
Yeah, and unfortunately, if you're on GitHub Enterprise with invoicing, they don't do that.
Yeah,
So,
they didn't do that.
and that's who really needs to be giving back to open source, in my professional opinion.
Maybe file an issue with GitHub Enterprise if that part of it's open source. And say, hey, make it easier for us to be sponsors.
So one of the nice things I discovered that GitHub does for sponsorships on this side is they help you see your supply chain, so you can see the projects your organization depends on, and donate directly to those projects. But they exclude Terraform as a language, even though it's like in a top five language or something on GitHub, top 10 at least. So, anyways, I did email them. The reason why I brought that up is I emailed them about that, and they never got back to me. Oh well, you win some, you lose some. I did pursue
I'm
some
sure they'll
projects.
get back someday, right?
Yeah. So the next one was brought to my attention surprisingly by a non-techie who works at Halliburton. I hadn't seen this, and apparently it was under the radar for a little while. Today or yesterday, I think it was on TechCrunch and elsewhere. Halliburton has experienced a significant ransomware attack, but they haven't gone into too many details yet on the nature of that, though customer information has been compromised, apparently. Anyone know more about the cyber attack? It's a ransomware type of thing.
Hope they have backups.
Next announcement was, I thought this was kind of cool. I think it was trending on Hacker News over the weekend or so. One of the most annoying things as a consumer of RSS for me has always been, well, you don't actually get the full content usually. And if you start subscribing to a feed, it's limited, like to whatever the blogging software sets as that limit. And I don't think it's really to thwart bad actors so much as just their practical limits to these things. And that's what they set. Well, this is a host self-hosted service that I believe will scrape the RSS feeds and also index or scrape the actual linked article so you get the full text of the RSS feed. And if
What's
you're
it called?
it's called this Doge Sec.
Okay.
We'll share a link in a little bit after office hours here.
Thank
But
you.
at least that's my understanding of what it does. Maybe it is an open source. I thought it was an open source thing. And I know this is security focused, but I thought it was self-hostable. Maybe I totally bungled that. So yeah, maybe it is just a hosted RSS feeds for security related content. But anyways, I would really like something like this just in general.
No, it's in their corporate GitHub and it's public.
Oh, it is. Okay.
Apache license 2.0. Yeah.
All right, sweet.
Last commit was an hour ago. So, yeah, other
Yeah.
people like it too.
The other thing I've wanted sometimes is there are different types of newsletters. There's the newsletters that have a lot of content on them, and then there are the newsletters a little bit like Flat Posse's, which has a lot of links in it, links to other things to check out. Sometimes I wish I could just have each one of those links as a separate item in the RSS feed, rather than having to open or read the post itself. All right, next announcement is this here. It's a proposal for a new like robots.txt specifically for training LLMs or specifically for LLMs training on your content. This is just a proposal. I don't believe it's necessarily been adopted by anyone yet. And it's not clear to me that it requires a new file format and that this couldn't be solved with robots.txt as well, but I don't know
Well,
what to
don't, I mean, don't they have like two different purposes? Like there might be content that you want indexed, but you don't want an LLM to train on.
expect. That's
Yeah,
true.
but if you could do that all in one YAML document as opposed to two, I create or text document as opposed to two. Yeah.
Well, the format, I'm just saying, would have to be different, or there'd have to be different keys or something at least to indicate that a rule that you're putting in there is for like robot, like spiders versus or web crawlers or whatever versus
In full
LLMs.
disclosure, I haven't touched a robots.txt file in, a couple like decades. So maybe it's changed since I used it last. So, okay.
I was thinking, I was going to joke. I say it's so great that people want to contribute their content to AI. Then they won't need you anymore.
The format has grown, but I don't know that it maybe supports enough metadata to
Yeah,
convey it.
I think that's the problem.
Maybe the robots TXT should be expanded though.
Oh yeah, that's different. Like that's a different proposal. But in either case, I don't think that the robots.txt in and of itself is wide enough to solve the problem of both.
Oh,
Like,
This specifically is for inferencing, not training, it says. So this is a proposal to standardize on using LLMS.txt file to provide information to help LLMs use a website at inference time. Live ingestion of live data.
Oh, interesting. That is different.
Okay, now I get it.
My slides did this thing again. Right.
I can't find the YouTube video right now, but I was watching one yesterday that apparently there's a way on several of the LLMs out there to ask it. You have to ask it in a certain way, but if you ask it properly, it will give you back various real API keys that it has learned as part of its training data. Accidentally.
You don't have to. That prompt's pretty easy. There's
Well,
a lot
a
of
lot of them now, if you ask it like directly, it will like they've fixed the prompt so that it will say like, if you need an API key for this service, please contact them directly. I can't give you that information, but there's still ways to like
speaking of cool
kind
ways,
of trick them.
open search, you could do use open search to do that yourself too. So, kind of cool.
I'm wondering if there's like how people are gamifying the searches to try to get people looking for a technical solution to download a Trojan. I wonder how long it'll be before they could gamify the AI to suggest downloading code or something that could backdoor into companies.
I bet there are even examples of that one could find right now, especially in maybe other languages that are more easily exploitable. All right. Next announcement. This was one you shared with me, Matt. I didn't have a chance to read through it. Obviously, depending on what camp you're in, this is either a sound or laughable argument. All right, have at it. EKS or ECS, more cost effective.
It depends on where your knowledge is and what you want to touch. If you don't have knowledge about maintaining hardware or versions or dependencies, or if you don't want to do any of that, then EKS is not the right product for you. But if you want all the switches, ECS is not the right product for you. So different use cases. It's easier to bootstrap something on ECS. It's more money. Like in the end, it costs more money, I think, because it's more managed. But you can start something on ECS and migrate to EKS fairly easily. Going the other way doesn't make a lot of sense unless you had a unique business.
Well, I think right there in the last line of there, it could say lack of support for stateful sets, Helm charts. Right there, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, stateful sets. I mean, a lot of the automation besides ECS, but even the autoscale groups and the equivalent of other cloud platforms, they don't really handle stateful sets well or at all.
True.
That's always been a one problem. If you don't have a horizontally scalable application that's stateless, then you're kind of screwed. I mean, Kubernetes and
Was it
Nomad
in?
and others are the only games in town.
Well, in Kubernetes 1.29 or 1.30, I forget which one. Now we can vertically scale without restarting the pod. It's still beta, but we have that vertical pod autoscaler now that we can dynamically assign more or less resources to a pod while it's running. And you can't do that in ECS.
Yeah, but I mean, like for the stateful apps, like if you scaling out on a distributed app with the different components have unique states, so that zero of your cluster comes back as zero and one of your cluster comes back as one and reattaches the volume that had its last known persistent state automatically. I'm surprised the clouds have never cloud vendors have never come out with that type of automation because there's such a need for it. And it's interesting because Kubernetes with a stateful set kind of leapfrogged them all and offered it, and they still today don't have a comparable solution, like say for the VMs
Yeah.
or AGS.
Not everything should be a container though, too. So I don't know if you need to solve 100% of edge cases with one product.
No, what I'm saying is, but they don't have, there is no solution for VMs. So, well, except for something like Nomad, but there's no solution from the cloud vendors for stateful scaling. So you,
Isn't Kubevert support VMs workload, or I'm missing something?
well, no,
Yeah,
what I'm
but it's not supported by the cloud vendors, right?
yeah, so the cloud vendor,
You're on your own.
for example, just spelling out the Pacific Tech as AWS has autoscale groups. Microsoft Azure has VMSS, virtual machine scale sets, and then managed infrastructure templates or whatever the M no groups in Google Cloud. They don't quite support it. The autoscale groups definitely doesn't support any type of state. Now, Portworx, a long time ago, did come out a solution that I think wrote off a console to try to manage this volume gets reattached to this one, but it was a completely, on top of the technology. But from the cloud vendors themselves, they never offer that solution.
The dude, one of the dudes in chat, Alex, said, "Don't be stateful." I think that's where you have to start, is what is the solution that you're going for, and is a Kubernetes stateful set the right answer?
Well, yeah, for example, like I worked at a company called dgraph, which is a highly distributed graph database that outperforms Amazon's as Neptune or whatever. And this thing's managing terabytes of data. The data sets of the graph, the predicates are replicated across multiple nodes. And so each of those nodes has a state at the point in which they're replicating. That's what there isn't. You have to use stateful sets or equivalent stateful support in whatever platform. Not
Or
everything is a web app without a state.
additional applications that are stateful. I mean, if you are
Yeah.
migrating workloads that aren't built to run that way.
Yeah, there's a different products out there that are clusters that aren't the old school SQL databases, and there aren't web apps that you that are clones of each other that you could just horizontally scale in that way. They have state. And that's a real need.
As a software developer, I would proposition those people to rewrite their code. So,
Well, the thing is, we have a
you
competitor.
can't always do that, right? Like if you're running Kafka on
You
Kubernetes,
can't, but you also can't work, you also can't make legacy code last forever. At some point, you have to break.
or All right. Well, yeah, let's move on from that topic. Next one was this announcement from S3. S3's been getting a lot of flack lately for being pretty far behind in terms of some other object storage systems that support operations that make it more convenient to use in an optimistic concurrency kind of way. It's almost like Amazon heard that and then quickly rolled something out. Unfortunately, this seems very limited in what they added support for, but basically the idea is that if you're building a distributed app and you're needing to write objects to S3, and it's possible that two workers, for example, write to the same object path at the same time, you one could clobber the other, and you have no way of really handling the failure case. Now it supports the conditional writes, which I think it, from my reading of it, it's more like conditional creates rather than conditional writes, because it's on, I believe it's only right now on put objects, and I don't know that you can do it like with a condition on time, but maybe I just skimmed this too quickly. Because the ideal thing would be able to update an object as well, optimistically, provided the object wasn't modified after XYZ date and time. This, I believe, only checks to see for the existence of the object before writing it and errors if it does exist. Anyone take a closer look at this one?
If I understand it, it's like if something's in flight, you could check to make sure that something is in flight. And if it's not, then up to that conditional write. If I'm understanding it correctly.
I didn't quite follow. So apologies.
So if I'm understanding correctly, let's say there's already that chunk or whatever is being streamed up, you're writing it and it's in flight. You could check to see if that's already in flight and finished before you try to write that chunk or whatever part again.
Well, that's for the multi-part portion of it, I suppose. It was which I didn't address, but yeah, for the put object, the first one, it's only on creation, I think.
That does look like a feature that should have been in the before the category.
Yeah. All right. Next update was ABAC attribute based access controls for DynamoDB. So you can tag basically your documents in document or in DynamoDB and set up IAM policies on that. This is a limited preview though, so it's not GA yet. You have to apply to start using.
And it's also a subset of regions if you look at that too.
Okay.
Subset of what?
Regions that it's available in to test.
My guess is that will be a release at reInvent or something coming up in a few months. All right, next one was, this is a old announcement. This is back from February that I missed. I didn't see that Amazon has a new service called the IAC Generator, which will scan some account for infrastructure, come back and let you kind of select what you want to codify. And then it'll generate the CloudFormation templates for you to reproduce that environment. So what caught my attention was today, this week, there was an announcement that they enhanced that so that there's better visualization now on selecting what you want it to generate infrastructure as code for. Has anyone used the IAC generator with CloudFormation? No. Was it news to everyone else? Anyone else too? Everyone else too?
Anyone ever enjoy using CloudFormation?
Before Terraform, sure.
And JSON?
No, I only ever did it in YAML. JSON makes my eyes hurt.
There's a lot of reasons to hate CloudFormation. Obviously, we are a Terraform shop doing mostly Terraform, but it does make deployments like trivial when they work. you can just post your document to an endpoint and expect it to get created, rolled back sometimes, often failed, which is why we hate it. But Terraform fails too all the time. So.
Yeah,
infrastructure as code.
I think just to be fair, really quickly on I think some of the it always fails is a legacy view, like all this time that we've been using, Terraform, they've been making huge improvements to to CloudFormation. And and I think I shared this one time before. So this goes back maybe about four or 5 years ago. I met with a maybe it was 4 years ago. I met with a product manager at CloudFormation and had a discussion. And he told me that something like 70% of all of their enterprise customers use CloudFormation to deploy their AWS resources. So, what we think we're doing in Terraform is a tiny little slice compared to like what what people are actually doing in CloudFormation, all around the world. So they've continued to improve it, and it's definitely gotten a lot better versus, 10 years ago or whatever.
All right. Next one is something that caught my attention. OpenTofu voted to block Russia. Due to US sanctions, presumably. I've seen similar mentions like this, like Docker Hub has, there was a post here, was not available from Russia. And there was people officially at Docker responding here, like I believe this one here, or maybe it was another one, but I haven't ever seen like the reference to the precise sanction, so I'm a little bit confused on that. Also, I'm not 100% sure if like for example the Terraform registry is blocking it, but I did find one post from 22 where someone said something to that effect, but I don't know if it's still true. And this is just a example, one example. And then there was some controversy around this, of course, because to some degree it feels like it's politicizing open source, and it's possibly inconsistently applied. So yeah, just thought I'd bring this up. Anyone have thoughts on it?
Well, they, if I remember correctly, they also deleted some providers, and that seemed to be a bigger controversy. They without discussion and without like a lot of reasoning behind it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they deleted Yandex, CyberCloud, and Roostack. Terraform providers.
But there's not much else they can do. I mean, this is a political problem, and you are forced to do it. It happens to a bunch of product manufacturers too, so you're kind of screwed. When I used to work on Sonatype, we had similar issues with certain countries, and for example, we couldn't sell our product to anyone in China, period. So those things have been around forever. It's not a new thing. So I would not condemn that they have to do that.
I don't know. I think this is like, I think you can get sanctioned for doing business with these other countries, but this isn't, they're not doing business. This is free open source software. So I find this to be kind of ridiculous, frankly. This is just, this speaks to me as the need for more decentralization. Maybe the OpenTofu registry shouldn't be like a US, a thing that runs in the United States. It should be like, I don't know, a collection of registries that are all federated.
Then how do BlackRock and other companies make profits? But I was thinking the same thing too. It's just like I always thought, maybe it's not true, but I always thought the sanctions were for like doing business and Russian profiting, not free stuff.
I think this is just a bunch of, I think somebody with enough power and who really wanted to do something that they felt was politically the right thing to do decided to do this. I guess they is, you said it was unanimous vote by some people or other, open to a few people.
Yeah, there was a steering committee meeting, and this is under the Open Tofu repository, and the attendees and the decisions by meeting. So yeah,
I haven't read the document of the sanctions myself, so I can't really comment on, you know, I can make assumptions of like what actually the tariffs mean. If it's only to sell products or making businesses with other companies, I think it actually spans more than that. So it's tricky to make assumptions of what they shouldn't have done, and maybe it's treated as a product. I don't know, but it's not a document that I'm going to read, so that's why I'm not going to make comments about it.
Just to be fair, completely unrelated to this, I was reading an article the other day that there are like over 300 sanctions in place by the US government against Russia, and some of them definitely, like I was scanning through the document on what they were, and some of them for sure are about like technologies that do certain things and a bunch of other things. So clearly someone believes or has been told, advised legally, you know, that they were doing something that was not in compliance with the sanction. So they decided that they would take, you know, they would take action to become like compliant with the sanctions. Now, we can argue whether or not open source should fall under that, or the technologies that are developed in open source and, you know, whatever they are. But at the end of the day, if OpenTofu was advised by their legal advisors that they were doing something that was against a U.S. sanction that's in place, and they became compliant with that, that doesn't, like, we should not hold them, hold them responsible for that. They're just adhering to what they should be doing.
Do the AWS modules Terraform still require you to enable Putin as a bastard or whatever to deploy them?
I don't know, but I know you're.
That was a required setting at one point. Otherwise, they would just not deploy.
That's hilarious. I didn't hear about this. Oh, man. Yeah. I think this was people, you know, wanted to do something, and this is the power. The power they had was the power over OpenTofu, and so they did what they can with the power they've got. Personally, a lot of sanctions, especially when it comes to open source software and free things, educational things, I only begrudgingly comply the minimum possible when forced to. If you're in like a SOC 2 compliant company and like someone comes after you telling you you're gonna have to start, you know, setting up your geo fencing, and so no one can get to your websites from, you know, these countries or whatever. I don't know. I push back on that as much as I can, at least on the software side, because it's just the war is not going to be stopped by someone saying, "Oh, I can't use this OpenTofu module." You know, like if they're going to sanction something that actually affects the people in power, not necessarily the populace. You know, like I don't want kids in Syria to not be able to learn OpenTofu because the U.S. decided that, you know, Syria is bad. And they won't let them have anything. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I kind of share that sentiment.
Sanctioning is a useful tactic. I prefer sanctions to war for sure, but I think they should just, I think it's a thing that needs to be examined much more closely. And I think a lot of people overcomply by default, you know, they're like, oh, do we have to do that? Well, let's just do it anyway, just in case. Let's just turn on all the Cloudflare blocky everything, you know, and make everything miserable for anyone who's on a VPN or, you know, for anyone who's in a country that's, you know, that we think might be bad. It's easy to overcomply.
So I just thought I mentioned, so I published another concept article.
All right, let's see what you got here.
People probably more familiar with this one, I bet. It's more recent.
Snowflake versus Phoenix. All right, do you want to give the rundown?
Yeah, so basically, the concept is everyone knows our lovable snowflakes, two servers drift over time for what the desired state's supposed to be. And so then they have multiple snowflakes. And then, of course, with Docker, more especially, the idea is that the servers are destroyed and then you deploy new ones from containers. But the concept below that's important because it could be applied at multiple layers. So the kind of idea is that you destroy stuff and recreate it with automation infrastructure as code from ground up as a kind of general principle. Obviously, immutable infrastructure, we do that. But there's other layers, like for example, people are familiar with ClickOps and the AWS Web Console. So that's not a Phoenix type pattern. I mean, so the idea is that you have automation that brings it up from nothing rather than having the old Jenkins server that they keep patching. That's the kind of the idea. So whether that uses containers or it doesn't use containers, it might use, Chef, Puppet, whatever. But the idea is destroy it and recreate it from nothing. And then you have greater predictability, better quality, better reliability, and everything. And that's the main concept. So whatever that applies to, that's the concept. You'd be able to destroy a thing, you could create a thing.
Would the I mean the other Phoenix server, would that be comparable though, no, to like the other common expression, pets versus cattle? Snowflakes are kind of your pets and the cattle are your Phoenixes.
Yeah, except I would say there's two extreme ends because there's like say kind of like four layers. So one, you have your lovable pet server, and you don't have like say fleet management of pet servers, but you can have say Snowflake. So Snowflakes could be your lovable single pet server that vertically scales, but you could also have a set of servers that are managed where you use like say Chef or Puppet to converge them back in the states that you're managing. And so that's their extra automation layer kind of going in between. And then the cattles is definitely a Phoenix pattern. You're destroying all the servers and recreating them for nothing. Well, not all the servers, just the ones that you're replacing or repairing or whatever. You're destroying them and recreating them from nothing. So those, the cattle and the Phoenix servers definitely is 100% match. But there's something kind of like an automation layer in between where you're converging several servers as part of fleet management. That would be Snowflake servers versus the pet, the extreme end of it is just your single pet server that may or may not use automation.
I was just reading here. All right. Well, I think, yeah, I'm gonna have to take a closer look at that and digest that. Thanks for sharing, Joaquin. All right, let's jump into the Q&A. Any questions we can get answered today? This is an open-ended portion of our call. If you're grappling with any challenges, architectural, technical, or just like career-wise, we're here to chime in. Yeah, I do believe we had talked about the someone shared passing on Crossplane by Masterpoint. Had seen, I think we talked about that one previously on.
I'm trying. Hello. Can I ask a question?
Yeah, fire away.
Okay. I'm trying to create virtual clusters nowadays. It's like multi-tenancy Kubernetes cluster. I'm using vCluster, but I'm using vCluster and Cluster API. But I found like Cluster API is not fully integrated with vCluster. I'm asking if anyone have experienced that or played with the vCluster or Cluster API before.
Not I. Yeah,
What is vCluster? I haven't heard of that.
vCluster is a virtual cluster, as it seems. So it will create like a virtual cluster inside your Kubernetes cluster. The separation will be like it's a namespace separation wise, but it's more yeah, there is capsule. There is capsule, I think, if you know it from Clastics.
Nope, I don't know that one very well either.
So, I mean, what are your approaches for creating a multi-tenancy cluster?
No, I usually don't. Clusters are not. I usually create a cluster per. In a small company, it's like a cluster per deployment environment for me. So I have like a dev cluster, you know, test, prod. So three clusters maybe. In a larger company, I do like a cluster per kind of major project per deployment environment. So you would have like project A, you know, dev, project A test, project B dev, project B test. Doing multi-tenancy would save you the, you know, $70 a month for, you know, the masters or whatever. But you also end up spinning up more of the same kind of like, well, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. Who does multi-tenancy well?
Yeah, I think you might be talking about two different types of multi-tenancy here, right? Like if you're actually talking about like multi-tenancy for like each of your customers gets their own namespace or own virtual cluster so that like one customer's workloads don't interfere with another customer's workloads of like your SaaS application, that's really hard to deploy a full cluster for each. And we've dealt with a couple of customers who have done that, but mostly we've done it with namespaces, and then we've used Carpenter to scale the workloads appropriately for each of those like namespaces and tags and, you know, all of those kinds of things.
I mean, like isolating the workload with namespace isn't hard. I mean, are there any potential of I mean, someone from a namespace can access another namespace?
I mean, you would have to essentially, you'd have to like break the, you know, the Kubernetes barrier that they put in place for that. Like you'd have to find some hack or some exploitation for that to happen. And I think it also depends on what you are, like what level of access do the people in each of those, you know, each of those tenants have? Like, are you giving them direct node access to, you know, the underlying hardware nodes? Can they just run pods on that? Can they just run a service that's running in a namespace? And I think that the higher up the stack that you go, the likelihood of being able to cross that boundary gets exponentially harder. You know, if you look at it that way. So I think, unfortunately, I think there isn't a one size fits all solution to this problem.
Okay.